Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Ira Melman reporting the chief opposition candidate in the Ugandan election was arrested and then released. Police did arrest Uganda's Forum for Democratic Change presidential candidate Kizza Besigye. Dr. Besigye was seized as he tried Monday to access the Kampala Central Business District. A Uganda newspaper reported that Besigye has been released. A party spokesman told the Daily Monitor newspaper in Uganda that Dr. Besigye had been arrested as he proceeded for scheduled rallies in the Central Business District. Some Ugandans tried to cast ballots Thursday in the country's presidential and parliamentary elections amid tardy delivery of voting materials. A top international election observer, Edward Kukan, was on the scene at one polling place.
These cases are worrying, you know, because every citizen of Uganda has to has the right to vote. And if they are prevented by this kind of method, then it would have to be criticized because it would mean they didn't manage organizing of the election right way.
The main opposition party said the delays were deliberate, aimed at favoring the president, Yoweri Museveni. Kenya's army says it has killed the intelligence chief of the Somalia-based militant group Al-Shabaab, but the group is denying the claim. Military spokesman David Obonyo told reporters Thursday that Mahad Karati was killed along with 10 mid-level members of the Islamist group, but they disagree. They say that the man is still alive. This is VOA News. Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu is blaming the Syrian Kurdish militia, the YPG, for killing 28 people in the bombing of a military convoy Wednesday in Ankara. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul. The Prime Minister called for Western allies to stand with Turkey in the fight against the Syrian Kurdish group, with some European countries and the United States supporting in its fight against the Islamic State.
Prime Minister Davutoğlu claims his security forces have uncovered irrefutable evidence the Syrian Kurdish group, the PYD, and its military arm, the YPG, were behind Wednesday's bombing of two military buses in the Turkish capital.
Kesin bir şekilde bu saldırının Türkiye içindeki bölücü terör örgütü mensuplarıyla.
He says the YPG attack was carried out with logistical support from PKK militants inside Turkish territory. Turkish security forces claim to have recovered the fingertips of a Syrian national linked to the Syrian Kurdish group from the scene of the bombing. Ankara has long insisted the YPG is linked to the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, which Turkish security forces are fighting. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
U.S. President Barack Obama has confirmed that he will visit Cuba next month to advance progress in relations between the two nations and efforts that can improve the lives of the Cuban people, is what the statement said. He wrote it on Twitter. Obama also vowed to raise human rights issues in talks with officials in the communist-led nation. The Twitter message said this historic visit, the first by a sitting U.S. president in nearly 90 years, is another demonstration of the president's commitment to chart a new course for U.S.-Cuban relations and connect U.S. and Cuban citizens through expanded travel, commerce, and access to information. Pope Francis said Thursday that Donald Trump is not Christian if he intends to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexican border. Trump immediately fired back, saying it was disgraceful for a religious leader to question a person's faith. Trump, a leading U.S. Republican presidential candidate, has promised to build a wall along the Mexican border from Texas to California and expel 11 million people who are in the country illegally if he is elected president. The Pope's comments en route home from Mexico came hours after he prayed at the Mexico-U.S. border for people who died trying to reach the United States. Francis said this, a person who thinks only about building walls, wherever they may be, are not building bridges, is not Christian. This is not in the gospel, he said. Not having heard Trump's border plans independently, Francis said he would give him the benefit of the doubt, but he added, I just say that this man is not Christian if he said it this way. Texas Senator Ted Cruz, another Republican contender, has also supported building a border wall. He joked that he'll make Trump pay for it. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Voters in Uganda are flocking to polling stations to cast their ballots in presidential and legislative elections. Many, however, experience delays in a number of areas.
That's Elizabeth Polat reporting from Kampala. Details next.
Also in the news, Kenya's army says it has killed the intelligence chief for the Somali-based militant group Al-Shabaab, but the group is denying the claim. And Burundi and the DRC are asking the UN Security Council to take action against Rwanda.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Mali, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, polling stations officially closed 2 hours ago in Uganda after voting was extended for an additional 3 hours. Voters stood in queues today to cast their ballots for president and parliament, but Newswires report voter frustration. The French press agency says police fired tear gas at a crowd. Also, the Associated Press says in one Kampala neighborhood, voters threw ballot boxes around the grounds of the polling station. This happened after they discovered they were given ballots only for parliamentary candidates and not for president. Also, the opposition party, Forum for Democratic Change, says their candidate, Chiza Besigye, was arrested as the polls closed. Besigye has been arrested many times in the past. This is his third attempt to unseat incumbent President Yoweri Museveni. He was reportedly arrested in the Kampala suburb of Naguru. His lawyer says that Besigye has been released without being charged and taken home.
While voters in Uganda flocked to polling stations, many experienced delays. Elizabeth Polat has more on that story from Kampala.
Voters began moving around the country's capital, Kampala, before dawn, making their way to their local polling station. In some areas, like the suburb of Mbuya, voting materials came on time, and voters stood by to inspect the contents of the polling materials.
You do like this. Are they sealed? Want
they
to see?
Sealed.
All right.
Yeah.
At the National Theater, where European Union observers paid a visit, voting also ran smoothly, and many expressed happiness at the process. However, in many areas, biometric machines did not work, causing delays and upsetting the voters. In other areas, there was an incomplete delivery of voting material. In the Kampala suburb of Chiabando Arisa, by 11 a.m., ballot papers still had not arrived. This caused a confrontation with residents and military police, who were dressed heavily in body armor. One man named Kagozi, involved in the standoff, explained the situation.
We are having ballot boxes present on the station, but no ballot papers. It's making the boys and the young generation here to react, and they are all now reacting and telling the Electoral Commission, why is it doing this? Is it supporting someone, or is it trying to hide something? That's where the problem is coming from.
At a polling station near the Electoral Commission, around 200 voters were left off the official register. This was confirmed by polling observer Simon Katum.
The total number that was estimated for the voters, it was from 8 a.m. It's supposed to be 981. Mm. But the number of ballot papers, there are 784, of which they are not tallying.
So there's almost 200 missing.
Yes, so that's why people are complaining about that.
Many voters cried foul, saying this is how elections are rigged.
It is not that smooth because, one, we're supposed to begin voting at 7. It's already coming to 9 o'clock, and yet they will not extend even a single minute towards 4 o'clock. Two, the numbers of voters that are supposed to be here and the papers that they have bought so far is less almost by 200-something. So where are the other 200-something papers? So some people are not going to vote, and yet our time has been wasted so far. So really, that's total rigging of the IS order so far. I can declare that.
Others were angry by what seems to be a block on social media. Residents from around the city have reported that without VPN bypass, they could not get on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. The Uganda Communications Commission confirmed it blocked social media, including Twitter, Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram, and mobile money, for what it called security reasons. The Electoral Commission has apologized for the delays and urged voters to be calm and patient. Election officials assured voters that as long as they are in line before 4 p.m., their votes will be counted. President Yoweri Museveni, in power for the last 30 years, faces a challenge from seven opponents, most prominently opposition leader Kizza Besigye, who has lost to him three times in the past. The opposition says the past elections were marred by vote rigging and voter intimidation. Museveni maintains that he needs more time to implement his development programs. Some voters say their priority is peace and stability in Uganda, while others hope for change and a new regime. Voters also say they are concerned about employment opportunities, especially for young people, and health care and education. More than 15 million people are registered to vote in Uganda. Security forces are enforcing tight security as voters face some long wait times to cast their votes. Museveni has been in power since 1986, the end of Uganda's five-year civil war. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Kenya's army says it has killed the intelligence chief for the Somali-based militant group Al-Shabaab, but the group is denying the claim. Military spokesman David Obonyo says that Mahad Karate, also known as Abdurrahim Mohammed Wasami, was killed along with 10 mid-level members of Al-Shabaab in an airstrike in southern Somalia on February 8th. A pro-Al-Shabaab website is reporting that Karate is fine. It says no airstrikes hit the camp. The U.S. State Department has offered a $5 million reward for information that brings Karate to justice. It says he plays a key role in the wing of Al-Shabaab responsible for the assault on Kenya's Garissa University last April that killed nearly 150 people.
Burundi and the Democratic Republic of the Congo are asking the UN Security Council to take action against Rwanda. They say Kigali has been arming refugees from Burundi to overthrow the government of President Pierre Nkurunziza. The French press agency says the DRC has asked the council to press Rwanda to end its operations against Burundi. The UN Secretary General will go to Burundi on Monday to encourage a political settlement between the government and opposition.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yusu Heap, 13 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Ugandans today are casting their ballots for president and parliament. Kenya's army says it has killed the intelligence chief for the Somali-based militant group Al-Shabaab, but the group is denying the claim. And the Burundi and the Democratic Republic of the Congo are asking the UN Security Council to take action against Rwanda. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Hungary has charged a Syrian with an act of terror today for an incident in which migrants clashed with police at a border crossing last September. The French news agency says prosecutors in a town near the Serbian border are enforcing a strict new law prohibiting incitement of violence. They allege that the 40-year-old man led an effort to illegally cross the border the day after the government erected a razor wire barricade. Authorities claim 15 police and more than 100 migrants and refugees were injured as demonstrators threw stones and police used water cannons and tear gas to control the crowd. Also, a black and white news photograph of a refugee passing a baby under the same barricade has received the World Press Photo of the Year award today. Australian freelance photographer Warren Richardson took the pre-dawn photograph as the man tried to squeeze the infant through the razor wire fencing.
More than 1 million migrants and refugees arrived in Europe last year, with most escaping conflict. Even more may attempt to enter this year. Thousands have died making the sea journey from Turkey to Greece or from North Africa to Italy. But many thousands also die or go missing every year in unknown circumstances, leaving their families wondering what happened to them. The Missing Migrants Project is an attempt to find out. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
William Lacey Swing says the fate of many migrants is a mystery. Swing is Director General for the International Organization for Migration.
No one really knows how many people die or go missing. We have fairly good estimates on the ones that we can track. We know last year, for example, was a record year of more than 5,300 who actually died along the migratory routes. But that doesn't count for how many others may have died in the desert or along other migratory paths. It's very difficult.
The Missing Migrants Project is a joint effort by IOM and the International Commission on Missing Persons. Swing says it began on October 3rd of 2013, following a boat sinking near the Italian island of Lampedusa. More than 360 people died. Many of the victims were from Eritrea, Somalia, and Ghana, who had sailed from the Libyan port of Misrata. A few days later, another boat sank in the same area, killing more than 30 people. Many times, the bodies of missing migrants are never found or identified. A review of some 3,000 cases between 1990 and 2013 showed that fewer than half the bodies were identified.
For the missing, of course, these are bodies that you never see, you never know about. And the difficulty there is not only the grief and the permanent loss for a family, a loved one, but it's sort of like double jeopardy in a sense, because you can never come to closure, either personally, mentally, or spiritually.
And Swing says there's no closure legally either.
Is my spouse still alive? Am I a widow, a widower? What about joint property claims? So, you see, it's particularly agonizing when these people go missing and there's no way to find the body.
The former U.S. ambassador to South Africa says there are many drivers putting millions of people in motion.
We now have simultaneous, complex, and protracted crises from the western bulge of Africa across to the Bay of Bengal, with very few stable spots in between, whether it's Ebola in West Africa or the Boko Haram in Nigeria, unfinished problems in Libya and Yemen, South Sudan, Central African Republic, Afghanistan, Iraq, and of course the biggest one of all, the six-year war in Syria.
Yet another driver of migration, he says, is the growing economic disparity between the global north and the global south. The huge influx of migrants and refugees in Europe has been called the biggest such crisis since World War II. The head of the International Organization for Migration sees it differently.
Well, this is not language that we would use at IOM. We see it more as a migration challenge. It's more a crisis of union and a crisis of leadership in many ways than a migration crisis, because were there greater unity in the areas that migrants are going to, and a willingness to share responsibility, the numbers would then be manageable.
The IOM and the International Commission on Missing Persons say that the international community has yet to develop a coherent and effective strategy to not only deal with the current problems, but that of missing migrants. They say while governments dither, casualties continue to rise. In an aviation disaster, Swing says everything is done to ensure that all passengers and crew are accounted for. He says this does not happen when boats carrying migrants and refugees capsize. The passengers often do not have identity papers, and there are no legal or insurance reasons to account for them. The Missing Migrants Project relies on 10,000 people deployed in 480 sites in 160 countries. The goal is to use the ICMP's identification database management system to process missing persons' information. This would include genetic sampling, testing, and DNA matching to help identify deceased migrants.
We're doing a lot now through social media, and I think we've been quite frankly surprised at how much response, very positive response we've gotten. Once people understand the numbers and the tragedy that this represents for the families and the loved ones. So I think there is something that we can do there to get these governments to help us to track the deaths of migrants and those who've gone missing along the migratory routes worldwide.
The project aims to seek the cooperation of governments and others in accounting for missing persons from conflict, human rights abuses, disasters, organized crime, irregular migration, and other circumstances. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Authorities in Ghana say at least 53 people died in a collision between a bus and a truck on a highway north of the capital, Accra, last night. Some 23 people were reported injured in the crash. Ghana's President John Mahama tweeted a condolence message early today, adding that emergency officials were working to rescue people from the site of the crash at Kintampo in the Brong Ahafo region.
The worst El Nino weather phenomenon in 15 years has brought devastating drought and some flooding in eastern and southern Africa. UNICEF says the impact is greatest on the children of the region. Reporter Delia Robertson has more on the story from Johannesburg.
Millions of children in eastern and southern Africa are exposed to conflict, to drought, to HIV/AIDS, and poverty. Now, as the worst El Nino weather phenomenon in half a century ravages the region, they are already bearing the brunt of crop failures due to severe drought and, in some cases, flooding. Megan Gilgan, regional UNICEF emergency advisor, says the disaster is spread wide.
As you know, we have seen some of the worst rain performance in this region in a generation. In southern Africa, we've seen some of the driest years in the last 30 years, and similarly in the northern part of the Horn, affecting northern Ethiopia and northern parts of Somalia.
In southern Africa, Zimbabwe and Lesotho have declared states of emergency, and the South African maize crop is down by 30%. Mahimbo Mdao, UNICEF representative in Malawi, says that malnutrition has skyrocketed among the children of the country.
We are having massive increase, 100%, which is a shocking number in any place, in terms of severe acute malnutrition compared to previous admissions on the year. And normally, when you get to this kind of time in the year, which is called the lean season, maybe you have a 10% increase, which the structures are able to cope to with. Maybe we have to provide extra nutritional food, but nothing significant as we've had to do this year.
Across the region, children are dropping out of school due to lack of funds or to supplement the family income. In some cases, children are left unattended as their parents move in pursuit of work. Mdao says some children in Malawi are already resorting to extreme measures.
So we're seeing desperate behaviors. We've done two studies to look at how people are coping, particularly girls and children, and we are seeing transactional sex starting to happen for people to be able to get food.
Gilgan says that water supplies are critical.
Acute lack of water is one of the critical issues in this region. So working with governments and partners to make sure that water supplies are functioning, if they're not, that new water supplies are put in place. And across the board, trying to make sure that that water, when available, is safer for consumption and doesn't spread disease.
Poor water and inadequate nutrition often lead to disease. Mdao says this is already being seen in Malawi.
And as we're seeing, you're getting higher disease burdens. One of them is cholera. We had quite a lot of cholera this year in Malawi, and it was widespread. Normally it's in one or two areas, around an area called Lake Chirua, but this time it's gone past Lilongwe and into the north, which is highly unusual.
Gilgan says at present, UNICEF needs $155 million to support its response to the crisis, but has only received 15% of this amount. She says that as the crisis deepens, funding needs will increase. Delia Robertson for VOA Africa, Johannesburg.
Thank you, Delia. A new study on the Zika virus says it has been detected in the amniotic fluid of two pregnant women whose fetuses had been diagnosed with microcephaly. The birth defect causes infants to have abnormally small heads and other problems. The findings reported in the Lancet Infectious Diseases concern an outbreak of the Zika in Polynesia in 2013. Researchers say that previous studies have identified Zika virus in the saliva, breast milk, and urine of mothers and their newborn babies. The new study suggests that the Zika virus is able to cross the placental barrier and infect the fetus. The placenta consists of layers of tissue that regulate the exchange of substances between mother and fetus. This exchange could include infections. However, more study is needed. Researchers say the findings still do not confirm that Zika was the cause of microcephaly in the two babies.
And since Zika often shows no symptoms, the WHO says men and women living in areas where local transmission of Zika virus is known to occur should consider adopting safer sexual practices or abstaining from sexual activity. What's more, the World Health Organization says men and women returning from where local transmission of Zika virus is known to occur should adopt safer sexual practices or consider abstinence for at least 4 weeks after return. In related news, the World Bank Group has made $150 million available to countries in the Caribbean and Latin America to support anti-Zika efforts. The bank also forecasts the short-term economic impact on the region from Zika will be $3.5 billion.
Ivory Coast's biggest private electricity producer completed a project yesterday that will boost the nation's production capacity, consolidating the country's importance as one of the region's major electricity exporters. Emily Yeo reports from Abidjan.
Ivory Coast electricity producer Sipral Steam and Heat Turbine, the last phase of a $382 million project in the commercial capital, Abidjan, is expected to boost the company's total production capacity by about 70% to 556 megawatts, a bit more than one quarter of the country's national production, and thus making Sipral the country's biggest independent electricity producer. During the launch ceremony, Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara expressed his satisfaction, saying the country has neared its goal of reaching 2,000 megawatts in production capacity by 2016. I am very proud to tell the Ivorian people that not only do we have more electricity, Ouattara said, but we also have good quality electricity to improve everyday life of our citizens and also to help neighboring countries. Ivory Coast is one of the leading electricity exporters in West Africa, supplying neighboring Ghana, Mali, Burkina Faso, Togo, and Benin. Adama Tungara, the Ivorian Minister for Oil and Energy, says the nation has been massively investing to increase its electricity production in order to keep up with the growing demand.
La forte croissance de la demande en électricité, estimée à 10% par an.
Tungara said the growing demand in electricity, estimated to be 10% annually and linked to the strong economic growth, led Ivory Coast to start several other construction projects regarding electrical infrastructures. Tungara said the country plans to triple its electricity production capacity by 2030 for an estimated investment of $22 billion, mostly financed by the private sector. The World Bank says power shortages trim more than 2 percentage points from annual growth in GDP on average in Africa. In Nigeria, the loss has been almost 4 percentage points a year. Emilio from VOA News in Abidjan.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis, Sami Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Batwe, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
Next on Let's Talk. Bullying. Are you intimidated by it? Why does it happen? What is your experience? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing bullying. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Ugandans stood in queues today to cast their ballots for president and parliament. Kenya's army says it has killed the intelligence chief for the Somali-based militant group Al-Shabaab, but the group is denying the claim. And Burundi and the DRC are asking the UN Security Council to take action against Rwanda. Coming up, we'll have music from Mali, and in our feature segment, the World Bank says Zimbabwe's economic outlook is not good. I'm Kim Lewis with Mahias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have kudos for a couple of record-setting African athletes.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Kenzeba Dibaba of Ethiopia and Ayanle Suleiman of Djibouti, who set indoor world records in Stockholm, Sweden. The 25-year-old Kenzeba set a new world record in the women's mile, clocking 4 minutes and 13.31 seconds. She broke the previous record set by Romania's Doina Malinte by nearly 4 seconds. The Ethiopian star was named the IAAF's World Female Athlete of the Year for 2015. Kenzeba says the Stockholm track has been very good to her. This is the third consecutive year she set an indoor world record in Stockholm, having previously set the 3,000 and 5,000-meter world records. Meanwhile, Ayanle Suleiman of Djibouti set an indoor world record for 1,000 meters, which, like the mile, is not an official Olympic distance. His time was 2 minutes and 14.20 seconds. Our African football guru, David Legg, has been looking at the recent results in the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup club tournaments. This evening, David's focus is the Confed Cup.
The results, Sammy, we start with V-Club Makanda of Congo, 0. Akwa United of Nigeria, 1. Police of Rwanda, 3. Atlabara of South Sudan, 1. Sagrada Esperanca of Angola, 1. Ajax Cape Town of South Africa, 2. Kagnoa of Ivory Coast, 2. USFAS of Mali, 0. Kwakap Marrakesh of Morocco, 3. USFA of Burkina Faso, 0. Light Stars of Seychelles, 0. Bidvest Wits of South Africa, 3. Renaissance of Chad, 1. New Stars of Douala, Cameroon, 0. Harare City of Zimbabwe, 3. Adema of Madagascar, 2. Barajin of Mali, 1. Stade Gabessien of Tunisia, 1. Asarawa United of Nigeria, 2. Generation Foot of Senegal, 1. Defense of Ethiopia, 1. Mizr El Makwash of Egypt, 3. Lupopo of DR Congo, 2. Bandari of Kenya, 0. Al-Ittihad of Libya, 4. Sonadep of Niger, 1. UMS Loom of Cameroon, 0. Desportivo Mongomo of Guinea Equatorial, 0. Khartoum of Sudan, 0. Villa of Uganda, 1. Fomboni of Comores, 1. Atletico Olympic of Burundi, 0. And Diablo Noir of Congo, 1. Africa Sports of Ivory Coast, 2. There were also a couple of byes, Sonny. JKU of Zanzibar and Maludia Oran advanced to the round of 32 after the withdrawals of Gaborone United of Botswana and Waledan of Gambia.
David, now let's go to Lubumbashi in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where TP Mazembe will host Etoile Sahel of Tunisia in the annual Super Cup match this coming weekend. How is that shaping up?
That's a very attractive pairing, Sonny, and that match will be on Saturday afternoon. And one significant factor is that two of the players responsible for Mazembe and Etoile Sahel winning CAF club competitions last year will not be in action. The leading scorers, in fact, you have Mbwana Ali Samata, the Tanzanian, who scored 7 goals in the Champions League last year to make him the joint top scorer. He's now playing for Genk in Belgium. And on the other side of the fence, so to speak, you've got Bagdad Bounedjah. He was the Algerian who played for Etoile Sahel. He was the joint leading scorer in the CAF Confederation Cup with 6 goals. He's now playing in Qatar. So both sides looking really at finding new sharpshooters. It's also Sonny going to mark a debut as Mazembe coach at CAF level for Hubert Velloot. He's a former goalkeeper, he's a Frenchman, and he's taking over from compatriot Patrice Carteron. Carteron quit the club in January after a really disappointing FIFA Club World Cup campaign, Mazembe finishing 6th out of 7. Now, in this competition, Sonny, I always feel that the odds are balanced very much in favour of the Champions League winners. I looked at the statistics, and sure enough, there have been 23 Super Cup matches, and 20 have been won by the African champions. And the reason for that is, apart from the first 3 years and one other occasion when CAF were celebrating their 50th birthday, the Champions League winners have home advantage. And being a one-off match, that to me, Sonny, gives the home side a huge advantage. Now, what they do in Europe is they play this match in a neutral country. Unfortunately, that doesn't work in Africa. Fans just don't have the financial resources to travel. And then in the first 3 years of the competition, they did try it. Crowds were very poor, and CAF decided to cut their losses and give home advantage. My suggestion, Sonny, is if you've got to play it at the grounds of the clubs involved, then it's got to become a two-leg affair. I know there is the risk of fixture congestion in Africa all the time, but nevertheless, my plea to the CAF officials who are listening in is let's make this a fairer, more equitable competition. Bearing out my facts, Sonny, only 3 teams, Africa Sports in 1993, Etoile Sahel in 1998, and more recently, Maghreb Fez in 2012, have won the competition on enemy territory. So I think it's only fair and probably rather safe of me to say that Mazembe will definitely start as favourites. This match, Sonny, pits Velloot, a newcomer to CAF combat, so to speak, up against Fawzi Benzarte. Now, Fawzi Benzarte is a man in his 60s, and he is the joint second most successful coach in CAF club competitions. He's got 4 titles. The head of the field is Manuel Jose, the Portuguese, who, of course, has coached Al Ahly of Egypt several times, and he's got 8 titles. But if Benzarte can pull it off on Saturday and Etoile Sahel can upset the apple cart and win, then Benzarte goes to 5 titles and he'll be in 2nd place all on his own.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. In 1972, something called Title IX became law here in the USA. It states that no person shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from or be subjected to discrimination in any education program or activity receiving federal funds. While it makes no mention of sports, it had a major impact there, opening the door to greater participation of girls and women. But years later, many say the nation's schools remain segregated along racial and economic lines, and that girls of color are particularly affected in sports. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The National Women's Law Center and the Poverty and Race Research Action Council have studied discrepancies in sports resources. In 2015, they released a report called Finishing Last, Girls of Color and School Sports Opportunities. It says while heavily minority schools have fewer athletic opportunities overall, those limited opportunities are not distributed equally among boys and girls. It says girls of color get less than their fair share. Nina Chaudhry is the National Women's Law Center Senior Counsel and Director of Equal Opportunities in Athletics. She says there's been some movement on the issue, but not nearly enough.
We know that there are some changes in districts where complaints have been filed because the Department of Education has required districts to increase opportunities for girls to play sports. So there are changes happening regularly, but I don't know that we've seen a real change in terms of opportunities for girls of color.
She says many people were somewhat surprised by the report's findings so many years after Title IX took effect.
One, the report shows that we still have schools across the country that are racially isolated, which is not surprising to those of us who work in the field, but we did show that 42% of our nation's schools fall into one of two categories, either 90% or more white students or 90% or more minority students.
Chaudhry says no one had really looked at the lack of sports opportunities for girls compared to boys in the mostly minority schools. The finishing last report says 40% of heavily minority high schools have large female opportunity gaps, compared to 16% of heavily white schools. Equal opportunity in sports, she says, is backed by the law.
There are several laws that apply to states in terms of making sure that the school districts across the state receive equal resources, both in terms of academic opportunities and extracurricular opportunities. So, you know, one area where states really need to step up is in ensuring that the school districts across their state are being treated equally.
Yet, despite the law, economic conditions can be a major factor in who gets more resources.
Often, the heavily minority school districts are in areas, I think, that are less wealthy. The way our school system is set up in the United States, it depends heavily on property taxes. So, you know, it's part of a larger inequity that exists that spans housing and schools and a whole bunch of factors.
No matter what the school district, wealthy or poor, white or minority, Title IX, she says, requires fairness.
I think the fact that girls are receiving fewer opportunities at all schools is a reflection of the fact that schools really haven't been doing their job. They haven't been assessing their schools regularly and their programs and making sure that they are dividing up what opportunities there are in an equal fashion.
Chaudhry says not having equal sports opportunities has a huge impact on girls in general.
We know that sports opportunities for both boys and girls bring about a multitude of benefits, from improved health outcomes to better academic outcomes. So girls who play sports are more likely to stay in school, to have higher grades, higher test scores. They're more likely to enter non-traditional fields that pay better. And they're also less likely to engage in risky behaviors, drug use, sexual activity, smoking.
Sports also contribute to leadership skills and self-esteem. Chaudhry says that often women CEOs credit sports for some of their leadership abilities. She calls on parents to make their feelings known to school officials or the U.S. Education Department if they believe Title IX enforcement is lacking. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Joe. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yehias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, trying to stop rape in Nairobi settlements. And next, the World Bank says Zimbabwe's economic outlook does not look good. But first, some music. Here is Amikota from Mali with Tata Sira. Thank you. Mali Zamikota with Tata Sira.
The organizers of an initiative to stop rape in the informal settlements of Nairobi, the capital of Kenya, say the program is succeeding. Girls take self-defense classes while the boys are learning how to protect the girls and respect them. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
Mary Ojwaka listens intently during a self-defense class. Today, she's one of 50 girls taking a lesson in close contact defense techniques.
No!
Ojwaka lives in Korogosho, an informal settlement on the outskirts of Kenya's capital, Nairobi. She's attending the classes so she has the means to ward off any attacks of sexual violence.
The classes are helpful because they teach girls who don't know how to defend themselves. If men come and try to assault, then they now know how to defend themselves.
Ujamaa, the non-governmental organization that runs the No Means No campaign, says one out of every four women in Nairobi's informal settlements has been a victim of sexual assault. The girls undergo 6 weeks of training in which they learn both verbal and physical skills to ward off attacks. Project coordinator Nancy Omondi says the program has faced some resistance from men who sometimes resent being portrayed as perpetrators of rape. But the No Means No campaign also includes classes for boys. In Nairobi's Isili suburb, high school students at St. Teresa's Boys' School are attending a class called Your Moment of Truth, which encourages the boys to stand up and protect girls against sexual assault. 18-year-old Patrick Makau has been taking the training for 3 years now. He says the classes have changed his perception of girls in society.
I'll be able to know the importance of respecting them, not taking them for granted. We as men or boys also, we should take these girls, our sisters, to protect them, not violate them.
Ujamaa runs the No Means No campaign in all of Nairobi's informal settlements. So far, around 30,000 young people have taken part since the program began 6 years ago. From the sound of it, the lessons of the program are sinking in. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
The World Bank predicts that in 2016, Zimbabwe will experience a 1.5% economic growth and that consumer prices will remain deflationary due to global and local constraints on its recovery. The World Bank says growth has slowed as dollarization ran its course and the economy's vulnerability to climate and terms of trade shocks has returned. Those predictions come from the bank's recently published Zimbabwe Economic Update. World Bank Zimbabwe senior economist Johannes Hedershi tells VOA's Blessing Zulu that prospects for growth are constrained in Harare.
At the moment, we project growth to be around 1.5%. We think growth of services sectors will continue to be really sound at above 3%. We expect modest growth in mining and in manufacturing. And then the agriculture sector is really having a very difficult year this year. That if you your listeners may know about developments in the rural areas, and it is just the news that is from rural areas, it is just very difficult, and we take that into account in our growth projections.
The World Bank has also used the word deflation. May you explain what this means?
Well, deflation is the opposite of inflation. Inflation is you use when the prices are increasing, and deflation is when prices are falling. And at the moment, on aggregate, in total, consumer prices are at the moment falling in Zimbabwe. That is, Zimbabwe uses the U.S. dollar, and in the prices are dollar-denominated, and these prices are coming down at the moment.
And what steps must Zimbabwe take to address its economic challenges?
Difficult global and climatic developments have made it imperative to and accelerate and intensify the policy reforms that can speed up the restructuring and the recovery of the Zimbabwe economy to counter the effects of external shocks. Many reforms initiatives have been started over the past few years, and some even more recently, labor market flexibility, leasing of redistributed and state agricultural lands, clarification of indigenization rules, easing the cost of doing business, mining fiscal frameworks, state-owned enterprise governance. There is a lot. But even though many of these reforms are not particularly costly from a fiscal point of view, they may have involved difficult political compromises. And very few of them have been fully completed, and so their impact on the economic recovery is delayed. In a difficult year like this, we encourage the authorities to really refocus their efforts to complete these reforms.
And from your dealings with Harare, would you say there's a commitment to implement some of the recommendations that you are listing here?
Yes, I think there is, on a lot of these things, there's really strong progress. And I think many of the people in government really want to see these things completed. It is just that some of the discussions within government, they take time. And that is to some extent normal. But at the moment, the pressures to complete these reforms are stronger because of the difficult situation in the country.
How are you working with Zimbabwe to turn around its struggling economy?
Well, Zimbabwe is still in arrears to the World Bank and to other creditors, so we don't have access to our normal lending instruments. But we do have a trust fund, which is the Zimbabwe Economic Recovery Fund, the ZIMREF fund, we call it, that allows us to provide limited resources in a small number of sectors.
That was World Bank Zimbabwe senior economist Johannes Hedershi speaking with VOA's Blessing Zulu from Washington, D.C. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States joins the international community in expressing zero tolerance for female genital mutilation, cutting. This practice, said President Barack Obama, harms and holds back entire communities. It has no place in any community and undermines efforts to empower women and girls. At least 200 million women and girls alive today have undergone female genital mutilation. The latest figures from UNICEF show that nearly 70 million more girls than previously thought have been subject to this barbaric practice. Female genital mutilation cutting includes all procedures that involve the partial or total removal of external female genitalia, or injury to the female genital organs for non-medical reasons. There is no excuse for such blatant human rights violations of women and girls. As President Obama said, just because this is a tradition in some places does not make it right. This practice is harmful and therefore wrong wherever it occurs. That's why the U.S. has funded programming to combat female genital mutilation and cutting in places like Guinea. At home, the United States has criminalized the transport of girls to undergo female genital mutilation, worked with religious leaders and community-based organizations to raise awareness, especially in some immigrant communities where the pressures to engage in this practice remain, and provided grant opportunities for domestic, non-governmental organizations implementing innovative prevention strategies. The United States stands with communities at home and around the globe working to prevent female genital mutilation and cutting. We call on girls and their families, teachers, health workers, community and religious leaders, and government officials to act together to make a difference, said President Obama. It's time to put an end to this harmful practice and to allow communities everywhere to meet their full potential by enabling women and girls to meet theirs.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical jam. I guarantee.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.